fucking hubris again. There's been some more casting announced for the upcoming Amazing Morris movie.
Oh, yeah?
I know David Tennant is now attached to it.
David Tennant and someone else I recognised.
Emilia Clarke.
Yes.
She's linked to it. I think she's
a pretty good stage actor.
I can imagine she would be.
She's going to be in a production of The Seagull before COVID happened.
Yeah, she's got the clearly came up from stage vibes. So Emilia Clarke is voicing Militia.
I don't really remember the book.
It's one I've read quite a lot, but I guess you wouldn't have. Himesh Patel, who I've never heard of, is voicing the Keith, the sort of main character. Ooh, Gemma Arterton's voicing Peaches the Rat.
The actor, not the rat.
Yeah. She is very pretty. She's in lots of things.
Very pretty. Good voice actor.
Yeah, she did one of the voices in the Watership Down remake thing that the BBC put out at some point last year, I think.
I didn't know they did that. Maybe you told me.
It's not bad. It's not quite as horrifying as the original,
the
original haunts us all.
Oh, yes. Any listeners who haven't seen Watership Down yet, by the way, be very interested to know how traumatised you are if you watch it for the first time as an adult.
Yeah,
obviously I'm warning you now, it's traumatizing, so yeah. Don't blame me. But
yeah, no, it gave me full-on nightmares as a kid. Like, I remember regular nightmares about the whole thing that was going to eat the sun. And
oh really? Oh yeah, see, I didn't get that bad with it.
We watched it in school.
Really?
Yeah,
my dad let me watch it and got thoroughly told off, so I must have been pretty young.
Yeah, it was. I don't remember how young I was, but it was definitely primary school.
I don't know when it came out, actually.
I'm not going to look that up, because otherwise I'm just going to spend our entire soft open sitting here Googling.
So you're back into prep? Have you regrown your chef's calluses in the last 2 days?
Yes. I am a fully functioning chef again. The big ridiculous hat now magically sprouts from my head whenever I enter the premises.
I heard on a podcast that each of the 100 traditional folds in a chef's hat is to do with a different way of cooking eggs.
Could be true. Never worn one.
Okay.
I wear a bandana.
So you know one way to cook eggs, is what you're saying. I think that was on No Such Thing as a Fish, actually.
I have a selection of bandanas at work, so does each one count as a method of... How many ways do I know to cook eggs?
Yes, well, this is the conversation they had, I think. But none of them were chefs.
I know quite... I mean, also, how are you defining this? Are you defining this purely as egg-based dishes or dishes with eggs in? And at what
egg-based
point...
Egg-based dishes, surely.
Okay. But what point does an egg-based dish become a dish with eggs in? Like, quiche is a bit borderline, isn't it?
I would say no, because the defining feature of a quiche is the eggs.
Okay, fine.
You cannot have quiche without egg.
Tell that to
There is
a
no
vegan.
Substitute. Well, I there's no need. They don't eat quiche.
I'm sure I've read a vegan quiche recipe.
Every egg replacement I found outside of baking has been pretty bad.
Yeah, there is, I have
apart used... from scrambled tofu, I do like instead of scrambled eggs. That's very nice.
Yeah, I feel like vegan quiche is similar, like it uses tofu and...
Oh, right. Why bother? There are some foods I just feel like I just don't bother trying to eat anymore now. I don't eat meat, so I feel like it's probably the same with eggs.
I mean, eggs, I feel like, are probably the lowest ethically problematic one if you're getting them from a decent place.
Yeah, I mean, let's not get deep on the podcast, but yeah.
Let's not get deep on the podcast that involves in the show notes. What is humanity?
Let's not get deep on this end of the podcast. Like, we're starting in the shallow end. We're paddling out. And then there's one of those like undersea cliffs that we're not going to see coming. We're going to go out there and then suddenly infinity is below us. The depths of the ocean. We don't know what's down there.
Sharks.
Things with tentacles, little lights on their heads, you know. Fish that only look okay under that much pressure. And when you bring them up, they're just like blobs. That is the tail end of this podcast. But for now, quiche.
See, the metaphor was going really well until we came back to quiche.
Yeah, I wanted to bring us back for more, like... We completely killed our listeners who have that, what do you call it, phobia of deep sea.
I have no idea what the phobia is called, but I relate to it the deep sea is terrifying.
Oh, yeah? I mean, obviously, for the same reason that actually scary things are scary, but like...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I don't have a phobia of it because I'm very unlikely to ever end up there.
Yes.
And I'm pretty sure they can't get me from here on the basis we're quite far inland.
Oh, chances are low, but never zero. I have an anglerfish coming through your door.
Speaking of, oh, there's a knock at the door.
Or more of like a schlup.
Ooh, a schlup at the door. I wonder what that could be.
Who could that be?
Oh, a pretty light. And that's how I'm going to die.
Oh, there are worse ways. Right, so...
Do you want to make a podcast?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I'm feeling optimistic.
Let's make a podcast. Hello and welcome to The Two Shall Make Key Fret, a podcast in which we are usually reading and recapping every book in Terry Pratchett's Discworld series, one at a time, in chronological order. I'm Joanna Hagen.
And I'm Francine Carroll.
And today we are continuing our proto-Pratchett season with part two of our discussion of Strata.
Yes, deeper into the earth we go.
On the earth, into the earth.
Yeah, no, still into the earth, yeah. Metaphorically and literally, yes.
In, on, under, and many other prepositions feature in this fantastic book.
You should write blurbs.
I'm just glad I can remember what a preposition is.
Is there a preposition in your pants, Serena?
Oh, we're doing well so far. We are not good when we record at different times of day.
It's 5 o'clock here, listeners.
And all is not
nearly
well.
Nearly the witching hour.
The witching hour being 7 p.m. when I start cooking dinner. Note on spoilers before we crack on. Obviously, this is a spoiler light podcast, heavy spoilers for Strata, the book we're on. But we will avoid spoiling any major future events in the Discworld series, and we are saving any and all discussion of the final Discworld novel, The Shepherd's Crown, until we get there, so you, dear listener, can come on the journey with us.
Through a baffling series of underground cabins staffed by confusing robots.
And on a mechanical horse.
And that, yes.
Tell us what happened previously on Strata.
Previously on Strata. Double Centurion planet builder Kin Ahad takes up an offer of a strange adventure to an impossible world. Why not? Joined by Kung/human Marco and diplomatic Shandy Silver, she boards a ship for the journey to a disc world. Their guide, one of the first interstellar travellers, kicks the bucket almost immediately, and the unlikely trio crash land on a flat replica of Earth. They meet some Norse explorers, realise that Flat Earth's timeline isn't very long yet, and head off Hubwood to find out what the hell's happening.
Excellent. Well done.
That was as little detail as I could put in.
I, on the other hand, have kept some more detail in.
Yes, I thought that might happen. So, Joanna, would you like to... Well, you have to tell us what happens in this section.
Look, I've done my best. A lot happens in the second half. This is a really good book, but I kind of regret not splitting it into three. We went based on length that we could do two, like we did with Dark Side of the Sun. But
I don't know. I think just like immediate plot points, yes, it would be three. But I feel like discussion points, I still think two's better.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, Godspeed.
In part two of Strata, our intrepid trio head inwards to the hub. The Raven follows as a mysterious island turns out to be a turtle and smoke rises over what might be Central Europe. As the disc's mechanisms appear to fail, Kin fears the company is to blame. The pillar of smoke from the crashed ship continues to loom. On a break for a bath, Kin submits to capture by priests and bandits and is taken to a nearby town to await trial for the crime of being not of this world. As Kin awaits rescue from jail, Silver fills her in on the state of the disc, currently filled with panic at a potential second coming. A psychic demon joins Kin in a neighbouring jail cell. Marco attacks and Kin gets out, with Svando the demon in tow. As they take flight once more, Silver notices their distant corvid companion. On a break in a burned-out village, Kin realises that Svando travels by matter transmission. During a demonic interrogation, we learn that no one, and we mean no one, goes to the hub. Svando is let go as our ragtag bunch of mismatched misfits continue on. Closer to the smoke, they come across a hole in the world. Lightning takes out the dumbwaiter as a scarecrow rears its head. As they get closer to the hub and fly over what might be Baghdad, the gas runs out, leaving our travellers earthbound. Thankfully, an Alibaba-esque disc denizen, complete with flying carpet, rescues them and takes them to a handy oasis. A genie and a magic table provide almost anything they could wish for, except appropriate food for Silver. We learn that Abu, their saviour, is a collector, sending his genie out hunting for technological artefacts which he believes to be gifts from God. With the bitter memory of a visit from Jago Jalo in mind, Abu takes the trio hostage, leaving Kin in the harem and Marco and Silver in the zoo. Kin escapes the harem and finds a not-magical flying horse, using it to rescue Marco and Silver and fighting off demons with a magic sword. With the aid of the genie, they finally make it to the dome at the centre of the Earth, where magic doesn't work. As the world destroys itself and they make their approach, they disappear into the dome itself. In the dome, Kin destroys robots for attention, finds Marco and Silver, and literally fights off death before an explosion lands her in the control room. Marco wakes post-explosion and finds a dumbwaiter ready to feed both him and Silver. Robots sent by Kin lead him and the no longer starving Shandy on a two-day walk to the centre of the dome, where they find Kin and a waiting ship. Kin explains, via flashback, what has happened in the last 2 days. She's met the committee at the centre of the disc. In exchange for knowledge of the true nature of the universe and a working ship off the disc, Kin promises to return and build a newer, better planet for the disc's occupants. As they aim for the hole in the biohemisphere, and assisted by a legendary rock as they prepare to take off, Kin explains the truth. The disc is the nuclear disarmament dinosaur in the strata. Proof that the universe is, and always has been, a made thing. The builders created it 70,000 years ago, and history is just clever clues from creators. With the truth revealed and new worlds to build, the trio take off.
Yeah.
I think I got
twist in the last 20 pages or whatever it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's a bit of a thing. Like, we had the similar thing with Dark Side of the Sun, that the Jokers were revealed to have been there all along.
Yeah.
And a bit of a sci-fi thing. I think Hitchhikers had the similar. It was the mice all along. And
It does seem like the sci-fi version of, and I woke up and it had all been a dream.
The real truth of the universe is the friends we made along the way.
Yeah. So what did you think, like, let's do an overall, like, what did you reckon of the last bit of the book then? Not the last, latter half.
When I just read the book, like the peek behind the curtain for listeners of how I plan these episodes is I read the entire book, then I go through per section before we record each episode, put all my post-its in and write the plan from that. So yeah, when I read the entire book, I really liked the denouement and how it all came together.
Yeah.
Going through and doing post-its, so much happens and disparate things happens, and it's very hard to keep track of events that I enjoyed it less.
Right. Okay.
It's quite stuttery.
Yeah, that's... I read and do notes at the same time, but obviously I don't have to try and make a summary, so it's not quite the same. But yeah, I did not enjoy the second half as much as the first half. It was a little chaotic. Which isn't always a bad thing, but I don't know, it seemed to be propelling along for the sake of it at some points, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think I enjoyed the setup more than the payoff.
Yeah, I think that's it, yeah. I liked the characters less, and I liked the pacing less, I think. But then, like, obviously the pacing was going to change its setup to, as you say, to pay off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think some of it, the two taken hostage bits made it stutter.
Yes, I think that's it, yeah.
And I think, like, you can see where Pratchett improved as a writer. A friend of the pod, Mark Burrows, on Twitter pointed out, like, as he was rereading the book and listening along, you could see how Pratchett improved so much as a writer and started sticking to sort of a central theme and plot for a book, whereas, like, you try and explain what happens here and it's sort of I think Mark used the phrase, fucking loads, mate.
Yeah, I was really enjoying that in the first half of the book. Like, that's kind of, that works for my weird ADHD brain. There's like, oh, this is happening and this is happening and this is happening. I see.
Yeah.
But as you say, because it kept stuttering, I was like, oh, what?
Yeah, we sort of started aggressively interrogating how religion works on the disc. And then we started aggressively interrogating the meaning of life. And then suddenly we're doing a parody of Alibaba, but not really.
Yeah,
it
yeah.
It goes into enough there.
You can see Terry Pratchett kind of like almost flickering into fantasy a few times, isn't it? It's like he's trying with all his might to write sci-fi, but it's like, oh, fantasy. Oh, there's fantasy over here. Oh, a little bit of magic. Oh, is it magic though?
Yeah, there's a great line when Kin finds the mechanical horse and she's sort of like, how do you actually work? And then he explains and she's like, good. She was willing to believe anything as long as it wasn't magic.
Like anti-Rincewind sentiment.
Yes. Well, it's the famous quote, isn't it? Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Mm. Yes, and the other laws that nobody ever quotes.
Yeah.
Right, so...
Helicopter and loincloth watch. Obviously, many things fly, but I am choosing the swinging the ship around the bottom of the world to get it to take off with the assistance of a giant legendary bird as my helicopter for the episode.
Sure, absolutely.
No loincloths, but, you know, Kimmy's.
Bullshit, there is an actual loincloth.
Fuck, did I miss a loincloth?
Page 203.
Oh, what the hell?
I was wondering why there wasn't, like, an overexcited bit in the show plan.
I was really tired when I did the notes.
There you go. His craft was technologically advanced, and he knew how to use it. At the moment, it was folded up inside a pouch on the belt of his travelling companion, a large, broad man wearing nothing but a loincloth and a dour expression.
Yeah, I think at that point I had completely disassociated because I forgot what had happened in the previous 10 pages and had to go back. So cool. I am sincerely, sincerely apologetic to the listeners for...
Well, you don't need to be. I picked up. Yeah. That's fine. Imagine they didn't miss out on the loincloth action. I'm sure that's all they listen for, but as long as we get it across. It's...
Yeah, everyone actually stops listening to the episode after Helicopter and Loincloth Watch. It's the most important part of the podcast.
It's very bad for our stats. Maybe we should put it later in the episode.
Please listen to the rest. We say interesting things. We don't. Sorry, I'm just going to rip on us.
Yeah, why quotes. Are you feeling so bloody self-deprecating today? Pick it up, mate. Ego.
I just need more coffee and I'll be fine.
All right.
By the end of the episode, I'll love myself.
Oh, good. Yes, quotes anyway. Yours is probably first. Mine's right near the end.
Yeah, mine is first. This is Kin and Silver getting a bit philosophical.
Mm-hmm.
We all think we understand each other, Kin heard Silver say. We eat together, we trade, many of us pride ourselves on having alien friends. But all this is only possible because we do not fully comprehend the other. You've studied Earth history, do you think you could understand the workings of the mind of a Japanese warrior 1,000 years ago? But he is as a twin to you compared with Marco or myself. When we use the word cosmopolitan, we use it too lightly. It's flippant, it means we're galactic tourists who communicate in superficialities. We don't comprehend. Different worlds, Kin. Different angles of gravity and radiation and evolution.
So, yes, it's like a sequel to last week's quote, isn't it? It's more of the... Yeah, it's like a more in-depth.
Yeah, and I like that aspect of the book. I really like how it keeps interrogating the relationship between the humans and the other.
I do. It almost feels like that aspect of it should have a conclusion, but of course it couldn't.
Yeah, there's just not time for it.
I'm not sure there's enough time in the world, is there, to tie up that concept, but...
Turns out colonialism was the villain all along.
Oh, no.
God damn it, colonialism.
Yeah, no, there was
again.
A bit of that at the end, wasn't there? The
definitely.
If you leave anything long enough, everyone must become the same by necessity, wasn't it? Something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, I'll get onto that a bit more later.
Okay, cool.
What was yours?
Mine is when Kin is standing in front of the computer going, am I going to put that helmet on? That seems a little risky. And the computer says, we trust you. Trust us. The helmet will link you to certain circuits designed for this situation. We can give you not information but knowledge that you will obtain nowhere else in the universe. The purpose of life is to find things out, said Kin, doubtfully. Yes, who would shun knowledge? Kin sighed, reached up, grasped, pulled. Which again seems very much like the sequel to the one I picked last week, which is just
yes.
a, yeah, obviously I'm going to do this and find out. I mean,
obviously.
You would. I don't doubt there are some people in the world who would not take massive risks in the pursuit of otherwise impossible knowledge, but they wouldn't make very good protagonists.
I don't know, I quite like the idea of writing that now, someone who's just determined to not have anything happen to them, and yet...
Well, that's Rincewind.
Oh yeah, good point.
Wow. I mean, you can still write it, but...
but Terry Pratchett's done it already.
Yeah, next book,
better.
Yeah.
Okay, so characters.
Mm-hmm.
Characters. Obviously, we don't meet that many new people, and a lot of these are little moments. But I liked the elf moment.
Yeah, the page. Little elf praying mantis-y fawn thing.
Yeah, I like sort of building this. This is, again, Pratchett kind of slipping into fantasy.
Mm. Yes, the elf that looks like an elf when it's playing its music and hypnotising you. And
then you realise it's actually a creepy bug. That was sort of a nice... you can see where some of Lords and Ladies was coming in.
Yeah.
And I like the way fantasy kind of keeps cropping up.
I do and I don't. It's a little disconcerting for me because, yeah, and I like sci-fi. I really liked this start, like, as a sci-fi book. And
yeah.
Whereas, obviously, it's still good. It's well written. I am like, no, I'm trying to read Strata, not The Colour of Magic. Like,
yeah.
Rewind a bit. Come on.
See, for me, because I'm not that I'm not a sci-fi fan, but I'm much more of a fantasy fan than a sci-fi fan. as it starts slipping into little bits of fantasy and Discworld, it's a bit like, oh, this is a bit more comfortable for me.
Mm. Yeah.
It's like sticking an extra cushion on when you're dozing on the settee.
Then having said that, I very much enjoyed like the little alternate history references and things like that. So
yeah, I mean, I always like sort of weird takes on Earth history. It's fun.
Yeah.
Anyway, else we have Brickface, who eventually is named as Lothar. He captures Kin first.
Yes.
Who is sort of the bandit leader that's taken some priests under his protection as well.
Yeah.
And that was mostly fun for the description. He was short and built like a wall. Even his skin was brick-coloured. A thatch of yellow hair and wide moustaches framed eyes that glittered enough to remind Kin that intelligence didn't necessarily start with an industrial revolution.
Indeed.
So yes, he was a fun side character. And then we have Svandor, the demon.
Yes, the AI kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of a bit
AI. He believes
AI.
In himself, but it's quite clear there are limitations placed upon him by whoever made him.
Yes. And this whole idea of demons on the disc is a way to make it work and keep people in line.
Yeah, yeah.
And
kind of physical manifestation of the
things we all get a bit scared of.
Yeah.
Not that demons aren't real, of course. I 100% believe in them.
Yes, yes. We just don't see them out and about much.
No. I plan on becoming one day.
Then we have the raven, the eye of God, have... little Norse nod.
Little hint of Norse there. Obviously, I love a quoth the raven joke.
Of course, of course.
Quoth the raven, you're the bastard that dumped me in the vacuum.
Yep. Doesn't quite fit known. In with the meter, but I'll add it as another line to the Poe.
Yeah. Lesser known original first draft of that poem.
Yes.
That poem. Don't mention it.
Who's that bastard knocking at my chamber door? Oh, it's you.
You bastard. No, there's no camels.
Ah, yes. And then Abi Ibu Infra?
Yes, also known as Ali Baba.
Yes.
The guy who... this is the, you know, where I mentioned the whole technology is magic thing. I like him as an example of how the disc works, where he's started finding these magic... To him, magical things. They're actually very advanced technology.
Yeah, yeah.
And he has decided they must be gifts from God.
Yes.
And then set out to acquire as many as possible in a very greedy manner.
Yes. So supply side Christianity.
Yeah. So, gifts from God exist. I must have all of them.
Which of those magical objects would you want for your own home? I'm guessing not the table, because like you like to cook. You don't want to make yourself redundant.
Right now I want the table, but that's because I'm tired from work and really sick of coming home and cooking for myself. But I think I want the flying horse.
Yeah, yes. Let's be honest. Everyone wants a flying horse. That was a
I have always
question.
Wanted a flying horse, provided like it is very well secured so I can't fall off the flying horse.
You're not big on Narnia, are you?
I have read them all, but they're not my go-to.
Yeah. The Horse and His Boy and the Magician's Nephew would be the horsey books there.
Ah, yes. In fact, weirdly, those are the two I've read the most.
Oh, there you
which
go.
Are the ones that fit least into the story.
I'll tell you what, The Magician's Nephew, that is a satisfying prequel. Well done, C.S. Lewis.
It is. I'm always really gutted when it gets adapted that The Magician's Nephew never gets adapted. And I understand why, because he doesn't really have any of the characters in the same way from the rest of them.
Yeah, yeah. And it would make a nice little standalone thing, wouldn't it? Maybe not a full... Well, maybe a full movie. I don't know.
I'd see it as like a sort of bit of a mini-series.
I think I'd make it as the prequel after I'd done the rest of the series almost, because
yeah,
again, it's satisfying because it fills in the gaps, not because it's such an amazing story.
Yeah, it's nice reading them and reading the main arc and then going back and reading The Magician's Nephew.
For sure.
However, we're not a Narnia podcast.
What? Oh, yeah, right, that's right.
So, Death is here.
Death!
Which means, was there a Grim Reaper-type character somewhere in Dark Side of the Sun?
Ooh, not that I recall, but I don't remember a lot of that book already, so, all right.
So, well, okay, well, we've got to, as with this is proto-Discworld specifically, we can still say we haven't had a Discworld book without death in.
It's got a power scythe, the mechanics of which I don't quite understand.
Yeah, how do you...
But it's like, wheel, like a... I don't know, I feel like you put that in for it to be a high-tech thing, but then I'm not a farmer. Hashtag not a farmer. What?
I'm kind of imagining like a scythe, but it's like a bit of a chainsaw around the top.
Well, it's not a scythe anymore then, is it?
Well, it's scythe shaped, but the blade just has
point
a...
of that?
What if the chainsaw is like each little pointy bit that comes up is like a really tiny scythe?
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like he was kind of trying to make a point about like the large scale death in the same way that he did properly in Reaper Man, and it fell short. But anyone who knows about mechanical scythes, please get in touch, because weird farm equipment is something I'm vaguely interested in.
Yeah, so at the moment I'm mostly picturing he's just wielding like a combine harvester on a stick.
Oh, yeah, sure. Why not?
Yeah.
I don't know what a molecule stripper is either, but I was imagining that almost as a strimmer. So let's just make everything garden.
And then Death appeared wielding a particularly sharp pair of secateurs. Oh no, I've got secateurs for hands. Sorry, I don't know where that came from.
Oh, right. And then the rock. Not that rock. A different rock.
A rock with no cape. The only reason I really put this in is the rocks are quite famously huge legendary birds that I had never heard of till I started regularly doing the New York Times crossword.
Right.
Because almost every time the clue legendary bird comes up in the crossword, it is rock. And so I did eventually Google it a few weeks ago when it came up. I think I started doing the crossword... whenever, somewhere near the beginning of lockdown, because you were doing it and I am easily led. And I think it's like something like the fifth or sixth time it came up a couple of weeks ago, I eventually Googled what they were. And massive birds. Mostly sort of Arabian and the Middle Eastern mythology.
I think I'd Googled them a long time ago, because it turned out a couple of the legendary bird Pokemon were kind of modeled on them. But I don't remember any of the details. So
I'm going to go with it's just like Zapdos then, because that was my favourite of the legendary birds.
Okay. I liked Moltres.
Moltres did have a very solid aesthetic, to be fair. But I quite like the
idea.
You're
always taking a risk if you're leading with an electric Pokemon.
I wouldn't necessarily lead with Zapdos. I just thought it looked cool because it looked like an angry, awkward, ungainly bird, whereas the other two were very pretty.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. Yeah, no, that makes sense, yeah. I do like electric Pokemon. I think if I was going to be a gym leader, I'd be that. But, like, you'd lose all the time.
Yeah, they're really easy to beat. Yeah. You just need a rock Pokemon.
Anyway.
We're also not a Pokemon guy.
Not a Narnia podcast. Not a Pokemon podcast.
I came here to talk about the Discworld novel talk about the non-Discworld novel Strata and drink coffee, and I... still have
and
coffee,
I'm all
but
out
I'm talking
of strata.
I'm all out of brain cells. Jago Jalo, I want to talk about again.
Never going back to life. Kind of thought he would.
I mean, they've still got him
somewhere.
Oh no, I think they've.
I thought the entire ship is fucked now.
Oh yeah, no. So he's just like dead.
That's
somewhere.
That, yeah.
Rip. F in the chat for Jago Jalo.
It seems. Again, I think it's like. Practically didn't have the, and I'm not even going to say writing, I'm going to say editing skills that he eventually had, because I feel like the whole little bit about him being put in deep freeze and they weren't sure whether to or not kind of was leading to something that didn't happen.
Yeah, there was a setup that didn't pay off, and
even if it was just a bit more angst about the fact he died now, because no one seemed to, it was like, oops, made a big hole in the earth.
Yeah, you could almost remove the character entirely. It would be harder.
It would be, but I mean, yeah, he's
the catalyst.
The catalyst, thank you. Yes, he's the catalyst.
He's what gets them to the disc, but there's
he found it.
Yeah, but there's very little payoff. The only further thing we find out about him is that
he was mad.
He was obviously mad. We had not considered that any race would send its madmen into space. In a ship like this, only a madman would go. He killed the chairman...
But he did not kill the deputy.
And the committee basically kind of go like, yeah, we didn't really want him, but we needed someone to turn up. So we figured setting that loose cannon out into the world.
Yeah.
I would have been nice if his motivation had been fleshed out a bit more than mad and wanted riches.
Yeah. Oh god, there's so much I wish Terry Pratchett could have written for sci-fi. I want to hear his, like, clearly that he's got a take on AI, Like, he's written enough about AI that I can see he's got a take, but he never quite got to actualize the take.
Yeah.
Band name.
Oh, I like that. Mm. I would love to read more Pratchett sci-fi, like, in his later writing years when he sort of learned to edit and what have you.
Yeah. I mean, I'd quite happily read a lot more of this, but...
Well, yes. Yeah. And then the only character I really wanted to revisit in this bit was Kin, and particularly her anger at the disc being so badly made.
Yeah. I will say, before we go into the anger bit, I agree more with people's critical view of Kin in the second half, because she seemed very contradictory and messy and hypocritical.
Yeah.
With the whole, oh, I'm so sad that Kong did violence, also gonna do casual violence. And
yeah, she was built up really well. I mean, I did like her character in the first half, as much as I agree with a lot of Mark's criticisms, but yeah, it's really plot first in this latter half of the book, and as a result she doesn't stay in one character because she's sort of doing what the plot needs. And I think there's also this idea of, let's have some cool fight scenes.
Yeah, which I never enjoy reading. And Pratchett happily never really does again. Apart from proper, you know, bar stool across the head stuff, which is always a bit more interesting than everyone's good at fighting.
Yeah. There was one line when she's sort of in a something of a lack of gravity and she's got the magic sword.
That was quite good.
The sword jerked and Kin jumped, feeling her body curve behind the blade like the tail of a comet. Mm. I don't agree with her, you know, suddenly getting into casual violence, but I really like that line.
Casual violence is the thumbs down in the handbook, is it?
Yeah. No eugenics, no casual violence. Still yes on cake.
Still yes on cake. Okay, good, good.
Yeah.
Good. Like to check in periodically. So anger at the disc then. What was your thoughts on that?
There's a couple of interesting moments where she gets really furious. There's one where she's pointing out to Silver that you can't evolve a good science on the disc. I think she says, science is supposed to be the tool with which you can unscrew the universe, but disc science is only fit for the disc. It's stagnant.
Yes.
And then later on, she starts to just talk about really, really hating it. Not just that she doesn't want to be there, and obviously she's not having the best time.
No.
I don't understand. She keeps getting kidnapped and somehow ending up naked.
Place, honestly. I actually stopped noticing when she was naked or not.
It's not so much I noticed when she was naked. I noticed when she was naked and then didn't reacquire clothes, because I just kept thinking she must be cold. Where's the line? If we get back, I won't care who built the disc. I'll see that they're broken, busted, and bankrupt it. They've built a world people sail off the edge of and get chased by demons and are superstitious because that's how they survive.
Mm.
And it's her anger here because she... And I think part of it is her having to... She's starting to reckon here that obviously the universe is bigger than she's understood. And she's been alive for 2 centuries. She does sort of feel like she knows everything there is to know about the universe.
Yeah, especially if she's the one who wrote the theory that everyone loves so much.
Exactly, and how the sapient races fit into it. So as much as on the surface her anger is that the disc doesn't work, and I get that, I especially get that fury at the demons and curious people sailing off the edge.
Yeah, because I mean, she's a crafts person, isn't she? She is watching someone be very bad at her job, which she puts a lot of pride into, as was kind of set up in the very beginning.
And it feels, I think, to her, like someone has almost been bad at it intentionally.
Yeah,
it's not that someone is bad at building planets, it's that someone has built an intentionally bad planet as some kind of experiment.
It's like if someone like made a sandwich that exploded and you were like, why?
Yeah, you did not mean to.
It's not what sandwiches do.
Oh, I want a sandwich. Sorry, don't mention food to me, Francine.
Sorry.
But what's frustrating is then you get to the end of the book and she's learned the reason, and she's obviously she's still kind of shocked and reeling and dealing with it. But you never see her really reckon with, you know, she's now found the people who built this, who built this shoddily made disc where curious people get sent off the edge.
Mm.
And apart from thinking, right, okay, no more demons, you don't see her confront the committee in any way.
The committee didn't do it, did they? I think she finds that out in time.
Yeah.
That they're caretakers, not. And because they immediately do seem to care what's happening to the people. Like, help us save them.
Mm.
But yeah, she doesn't go, well, what the fuck was your creator thinking?
Yeah.
So, yeah. She doesn't seem to let that go.
I would have liked to have seen her reckon with that a bit more.
Mm. You do like a reckoning, Joanna. Always said that about you, Joanna. She likes a reckoning.
Reckoning Joanna, that's what they don't call me. And that takes us very neatly into locations, which this didn't really need to be a separate thing, but I wanted to talk more about the truth and the gallery and the disc and the builders, and this seemed like as good a place to put it in as any.
Sure thing, sugar pie.
Sugar pie.
Yeah, I don't know, it's late.
Let's not do that one again. Quickly first, as Marco and Silver are walking through, when they come across the gallery where they could see the disc,
mm-hmm.
I quite like that moment. Yes. Because it reminded me of, among many things, obviously, Hitchhikers.
Yeah, yeah.
When he sees the sort of the Earth being built.
Yes, they don't obviously have the same reaction on account of, like, not our planet, whatever. But it's interesting little switch away narratively, actually, as well, wasn't it? Because we mentioned last time there was only one brief switch away from Kin as narrator, or not as narrator, but as focus, and obviously that happens quite a long
yeah, I quite like the sort of switch back and forth at the end, and then Kin recounting the flashback.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
As she's also explaining, like, that we've got to get into the ship and go, like, now.
Yeah.
It all works really well. But yeah, the committee and the truth. So the big reveal in literally the last 20 pages of the book,
yeah,
is that the Spindle Kings weren't real, the Wheelers that came before them weren't real, that builders had made the universe the way humans make planets now.
Yeah.
And the disc was their equivalent of when someone's building a planet, they put boots in the coal seam or a nuclear disarmament dinosaur.
Yes. You really like that phrase, don't you?
You noticed.
I'm going to make you a jumper with it on.
Yes, please. That can be my existential crisis jumper.
It's too warm in here. I can wear my existential crisis jumper today.
As much as, like, yeah, I feel like this second half of the book could be better written because it was written by a very young, comparatively, Terry Pratchett, I do really like this plot twist.
Yeah?
Yeah, this sort of, it's not quite creationism, it's 70,000 years, not 4,000 or whatever.
It's still creationism, it's just young Earth creationism, yeah.
Yeah, right, fine. I think it's, the book tries and does, I think, quite well to interrogate what humanity is and what it wants. And I think to pull the rug out underneath and say, well, yeah, that's what humanity's like, and this is what the builders were like. They, not building wouldn't have occurred to them.
Yeah.
And to take that parallel of humanity spreading across the universe, building planets as it goes, and to imagine then the Russian doll effect of the bigger version.
Yeah.
Going through something else and building universes as it goes.
Yeah. I kind of like it in that it's clever, and yes, I like the rug being pulled out kind of vibe of it. I didn't like it because I really liked Kin's theory with the idea of the galaxies being life a billion years ago. And a call for help from our listeners, actually. I've got one of those tip of my tongue sci-fi moment kind of things, because once upon a time I read, and it may have been a prologue, it may have been the start of a chapter, but it was a lovely descriptive passage of the first few fractions of a second, or possibly the first couple of minutes of the universe, and the rise and fall of civilizations within that, and the war between dark matter and normal matter, I think. And I feel like the chapter, like, wrapped up with saying something like, and then the universe was 2 minutes old, or something like that. And it might be Stephen Baxter. If it is, I can't remember which book. So help me out here, sci-fi fans. It took an hour of my research time trying to remember what this was, because I remember it being such a good passage and it would have fit so well. Really hard to Google that.
I remember this good bit and it was a bit like this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like when you're trying to remember the name of a piece of classical music and it's not like a normal song because you can't Google the lyrics.
Yeah.
That bit that goes da-da-da-dum.
Yeah, so it might be something in Stephen Baxter's Zili sequence, because I know there's Dark Matter Civilization in there, but as far as I remember, those series of books only go back a couple billion years. I don't know. Help me out, guys.
But yeah, I think that was all I had to say. I like the plot twist. It could have been better executed, but I like it as an idea.
Yeah, I do. I just got sad that the other overarching theory that we got, like, little hints of until it finally got revealed as well, so I was quite attached to it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I feel like I work for it, reading a whole 100 pages.
I mean, I'll miss the concept of the Spindle Kings, but they'll live on in our hearts. Right, little bits we liked.
Little bits we liked.
Island turtle.
Island turtle, Joanna.
They land on what appears to be an island and it turns out to be a giant turtle.
Yes, that did happen. Tell me more about that.
Well, I knew that there were references to this in mythology, lots of different mythologies, as it turns out, because it was even a like brief plot point in Avatar The Last Airbender, which draws a lot from fun mythology and history things. But the version of it from history / mythology that I got a bit stuck on, and I apologise, I'm definitely going to say this wrong, Aspido Cologne.
Sure.
Cologne.
Cologne, probably.
Yeah, as in light turtle, like de Colonian mobile. So yeah, I think Aspido Cologne, which popped up in lots of medieval bestiaries. And it comes from Aspis means shield, and then obviously Cologne means turtle. And it in sort of mythology and bestiaries, it would lurk pretending to be an island, and then when ships tie up to it, it would drown them. Sometimes it's a giant turtle, sometimes it could be a whale. There's an old English poem that I am not going to attempt to read on the podcast because I can't read Old English.
Much obliged.
You can listen to me stutter through it if you want. The poem's called Physiologus. The whale.
The whale.
But in it, the monster is referred to as Festita Calon.
Cool.
Tolkien eventually...
Do you know what I said so confidently about the hard curve there, and I know we talked about it in Small Gods, and I can't remember where we settled, but sorry.
Well, Festita Calon doesn't have the H, so I'm going to go with a hard singer. Okay. Tolkien has a Festita Calon in poem in The Adventures of Tom Bombadil about a giant sea turtle.
Yeah.
And quote from Tolkien, by etymology, the name Festita Calon is a corruption of the Greek Aspido Cologne, round-shielded turtle, with the addition of the letter F, according to Tolkien, simply to make the name illiterate, as was compulsory for poets in his day, with the other words in his line. Tolkien commented that the tale of the monster that treacherously simulates an island is from the East, and the turtle is mixed up with a whale when the story arrives in Europe, so the Old English version has him feeding like a whale, despite probably being a turtle.
Cool.
And I have the poem handy if you'd like to hear it. It's not very long.
The Tolkien one?
Yes.
Yes, I will hear the Tolkien one, please.
Yeah, and I'm not going to subject you to Old English. I agreed.
You've done a quick change of mind there, no. Yes, please, Tolkien always.
Look, there is Festita Calon, an island good to land upon, although it is rather bare. Come leave the sea and let us run, or dance, or lie down in the sun. See, gulls are sitting there. Beware, gulls do not sink. There they may sit, or strut and prink. Their part it is to tip the wink if anyone should dare upon that isle to settle, or only for a while to get relief from sickness or the wet, or maybe boil a kettle. Our foolish folk who land on him and little fires proceed to trim and hope perhaps for tea. It may be that his shell is thick. He seems to sleep, but he is quick and floats now in the sea with guile. And when he hears their tapping feet or faintly feels the sudden heat, with smile he dives. And promptly turning upside down, he tips them off and deep they drown and lose their silly lives to their surprise. Be wise. There are many monsters in the sea, but none so perilous as he. Old horny Festito Calon, whose mighty kindred all have gone, the last of the old turtle fish. So if to save your life you wish, then I advise, pay heed to sailors' ancient law, set foot on no uncharted shore, or better yet, or better still, your days at peace on Middle-earth in mirth fulfil.
Eat your heart out, Lewis Carroll.
Yeah.
I like that. Good old Bombadil.
Good old Tom Bombadil. That's my new favourite poem about giant turtles.
Oh, well, replacing the old favourite, of course.
Yes, the old English one that I can't pronounce.
Oh, okay. I see.
Physiologius.
I like that too. And there's a little bit I like more now.
Yes.
Thank you.
And then my next one was seeds for the future, as in things that might crop up again in Discworld.
Ah, okay, yes. Which did you like?
Less I noted in this section than in the first section, apart from, again, the obvious disc. I like the sort of idea of the religion as seen through fresh eyes, which is this trope that every time it comes up on the podcast about how we're seeing something through fresh eyes that we know about, but the characters don't, and it makes it very interesting. Mm. I go, I know there's a word for that. And at some point before the next episode, we look it up.
Yeah.
I cannot tell you what the word is.
Oh, I've done it. I've looked it up a million times.
Yep.
Swear to God, I have. Let me see if I bookmarked it this time. Yep. unfortunately, I think, no, I did not bookmark that, but I will. I might look it up and actually, for as a very rare occurrence, edit myself in saying the answer because it's pissing me off so much now.
The word I'm completely failing to recall here is defamiliarization, or ostronony, as coined by the Russian formalists in the early 20th century. It is basically presenting a common thing or concept in a new way, so as to bring the audience new perspective. It's more commonly used in order to distinguish poetry or art, so it's possibly not the best term to use here for Pratchett's technique of showing a familiar scene through alien eyes, but it's the best I can think of at the moment.
Excellent. And so we have this moment where they're sort of having to confront religion because Kin's been kidnapped by priests. It's a strange religion. Everyone is evil until proved holy.
Yes.
Are you telling me that Lothar's god is returning and he's thinking of nothing but pillage, probably rape and murder as well?
Cute.
And I like this idea of, you know, what would happen if the rapture was actually happening.
Yeah. The lack that of goodness shown in the religious zealots being again the...
Yeah. And not that I would turn to rape and pillage during the rapture, but I feel like I wouldn't assume I was going to be taken up, and I'd just sort of try and make the best of things down here.
Yeah, yeah. Not sure. It depends on the nature of rapture, I suppose, doesn't it?
Well, yeah.
I need more information on the specific rapture before I make my plans, but likewise, I assume I'm not going to be taken up.
And then meme etymology.
Yeah. So when we are talking about something we'll go into more later, but about preserving the ideas of humanity, mm-hmm. Kin mentions meme pools, and that reminded me that obviously the word meme has been around a little bit longer than the internet, but not so much longer than you'd think, maybe.
No.
It comes from the Greek mimema, that which is imitated. So basically it's ideas, knowledge that sticks.
Mm-hmm.
Sticky stuff. And the word meme itself was coined by Richard Dawkins in 76 in The Selfish Gene. And after that, I think the study of memetics was, because I think that was the 80s, wasn't it, began. And
yeah,
then the internet.
And then the internet. And now we have so many memes. So I do love a meme.
Yes. But I suppose loosely one meme could be things like folklore and nursery rhymes and things like that, couldn't it?
That's what he was, well, not specifically nursery rhymes, but that was what he was talking about in The Selfish Gene. It was the idea of something like genetics, and it is from the Greek, but it's based on the word gene.
Yeah. Oh, something to make it more linguistically similar, like yes. Citizen and Denizen. Ooh,
and
links.
He effectively describes it as the ephemeral version of genes passing down. That's not a direct quote. It's been a long time since I read The Selfish Gene, but it's the idea of, it's like genetics. So again, memetics, genetics, the similarity.
Mm.
It's like genetics, but passed down as an idea rather than a physical.
Yeah.
So that's the one good thing Richard Dawkins did for us, that until he became a weird meme himself.
I feel like you go into the little Twitter black and white a bit sometimes with people like Richard Dawkins. He wrote a lot of good stuff as well.
I know. He just really comes off as a wanker on Twitter.
Yeah, he is a wanker on Twitter. So, eft computers, Joanna. What's an eft computer?
Well, the eft are the fun little tentacly dudes we met in the first section.
Mm-hmm.
Who sort of blobble about.
Blobble about?
Blobble.
Blobble about.
They'd never blobbing along.
Blobbing along. Oh, a little bit of Bedknobs and Broomsticks in there. No one else seems to have watched that.
I love Bedknobs and Broomsticks.
Oh, yeah, me too.
We're not a Bedknobs and Broomsticks podcast, however.
Oh, right.
Ethnic computers, they never discovered electronics, but they needed computers for their complex religio-banking organisations. So an ethnic computer was a 1,000 highly trained efts, each one handling a small part of the math, and it worked.
Pretty much how we went into space, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's also, if you think about how early computing started.
Yeah, I mean, a computer didn't mean an electronic computer until obviously we had them, but the word was...
To computers, to
think. It was a person, a computer, yes. Was a mathy person.
Yes. And somewhere in early computer design, knitting patterns came in very handy.
Huh.
Do I mean, I might mean weaving rather than knitting, but the idea of binary and these sort of holes punched out in the card. There were a lot of little old ladies involved in the early days of computing.
Very cool, very cool. I saw a tangentially related, as we like to do, an old 80s advert of 80s, I think 80s? Yeah, of Isaac Asimov holding up one of the pocket computers.
Oh, excellent.
Little, I think it was a calculator with a couple of extra little features.
Extra features.
Yeah, but I didn't realise Isaac Asimov had been used as like a poster boy for a literal poster boy. He's got very big mutton chops. He looks like a Victorian transplant.
We need to find that and tweet that out to the listeners because I think
it was either retro futurism subreddit.
Oh, which is a good one.
So I'll link to that. Yeah, yeah.
Love retro futurism.
Oh yes.
And thanking robots.
Sorry. Oh yeah. sorry, I thought that was directly tied in. No, that's my next little bit I liked. Yes, it is mentioned that Kin believes you are a gentleman if you are brought up to thank robots or a gentle person. And I was wondering, I can't remember if I brought this up on the podcast before. Do you thank Siri?
I don't really use Siri.
Do you thank your AI? Like, if you are talking to, I found myself, and I'm not sure if it's just because I'm still reasonably new to using these things, but if I go, hey, Siri, start a timer for 10 minutes, I usually go, please. Thanks, Siri.
How many of our listeners did we just do that to?
Oh, shit, yeah, sorry.
I'm just going to throw in, hey, Alexa, just to really fuck all of them off. I don't have an Alexa device in my house. I don't think I use any, like, voice-controlled AI ever.
Okay.
I've just never got into the habit of it, so I don't think... I do tend to say please on the rare occasions I do.
Yeah.
But, like, I just don't tend to use it.
Is it... Do you think it's right to do so? I know it's a bit of a silly right and wrong thing, but I do feel... I don't know. I feel like it... Oh my god, I'm going to sound so old. I feel like it encourages bad manners to allow, and I'm going to say children, because the children have been the ones I've seen doing it, just go, Alexa, do this, Alexa, do that, like they've got a butler, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter, of course it doesn't matter, but it just feels inherently wrong to me.
I don't think it's morally right or wrong to thank or not thank your AI.
Yeah.
However, and we're both obviously saying this as people who are not raising children. Or AIs that we know of. Fuck, my sewing machine's sentient again. I do think it's right to always encourage good manners, and that includes thanking your AIs, because otherwise you would potentially encourage a habit of not saying thank you to actual people.
Disclaimer, good manners very much discouraged when dealing with pushy older men.
Yes. There is a time and a place for good manners.
And it is apparently when talking to one's phone.
Say that. I talk to inanimate objects a lot, and I do thank them.
Yes. Often sarcastically in my case.
But... Well, yes, true. I also swear.
Thank you, microwave. I heard it the first time. I'm busy.
Now I'm back in the kitchen at work. I don't really use timers and things a lot at home, but in the kitchen there's a lot that has to be timed really strictly, especially if I've got like a morning of baking or something. Which means I'll have sort of three or four going off at once, and I do find myself just yelling at them.
It's like, which app do you use?
Hmm?
Which app do you use?
I just use the timer on the iPhone.
And how do you have several like, going off?
Because we have like a bunch of physical timers in the kitchen.
Oh, okay, sure. Yeah. Timers on the iPhone, it's got its limitations.
If I really need more than... I think we've got two physical timers in the kitchen. I've got one on my phone. If I need four timers running at once, which is rare, but it does happen, then I'll set an alarm for the other one.
Okay, sure.
Which is why I've now got lots of weird little alarms set, like 12:07, rice off.
I could do actually with some physical timers because you always need to set a timer when you've got stuff on your hands or something, which is why I'll talk to Siri quite a lot. But then often I've got something playing through my phone, in which case you can't talk to Siri.
Well, yeah, I it's just really rare I have to time anything I'm cooking at home. I don't bake all that often, and when I do, I know how long things take.
Yeah, I've usually got Jack's meat going at the same time that I'm cooking something else. So, and also, I'm just not a chef and don't know things as well as you do. So,
well, I can time it by weird tasks. It's like I know this needs about the amount of time in the oven that it will take me to hang up a load of laundry and then put on another one.
Yeah. Also, it's the ADHD thing. If I go off to hang up a load of laundry without a timer set,
your kitchen will be on fire.
Yeah, it will be on fire. Yeah.
Anyway, that was a tangent.
Sorry, what?
That was a tangent.
Yeah, no, what are we doing? Talking points. That was all our little bits. Well done, us.
Yes, well done,
that,
us.
That was an intersectional... No, that's not right. Well, it is, but not anymore. That was a... God damn it, a palate cleansing tangent. There we go.
Yes, that was our little palate cleanser. Now, what's humanity?
What is humanity, Johanna?
I don't know.
Is that it? Is that the talking point?
Yeah, no, that's all I've got to say.
Joanna's just going to have a small breakdown on camera. I'll finish my coffee. We'll go home. It'll be nice.
We're both at home.
Oh, fuck.
You live there, Francine. No, okay. So I'm going to start with my sort of case study for this discussion.
All right.
Which is Marco trying to deal with his cunt. Which is Marco trying to deal with his cunt nature versus his human nature. And the sort of series of conclusions he comes to in the book, which, again, it could have had more of a conclusion, and it sort of got lost in the shuffle of the last few minutes of the book.
Yeah.
But I like him interrogating it as we go along. And it starts with Kin and Silver having this conversation where they're talking about the fact, you know, he's not physically human, but Kung believes their being is determined by the place they're born, which makes him human because he was born by humans.
Mm. But it's Marco's Kung beliefs that make him.
It's that Kung belief that makes him human. And if he is human, then he doesn't believe in kind of that, then he must be a Kung. And he overhears that conversation and he has to wrestle with it for the rest of this section. And he, sometimes his Kungness really comes out when they're talking about how they're going to get Kin out of the jail cell. And one of his ideas was to just massively blow something up. And Kin was like, well, that would kill us all. And Silver says, well, yes, but we would have won.
Yeah.
And although Marco is tainted by human ideas, he is Kung at heart, soul.
I don't know. Is that Kung or is that human? That sounds very much like the nuclear bloody option, doesn't it? Which
it's presented as. Yeah. It's presented as Kung rather than human in the book. But.
Yes.
If we interrogate humanity a bit further.
Oh, let's not. Well, all right, go on. Interrogate it.
Well, and this is, again, you know, we get more discussions of his inhuman slaughter. And as you pointed out, you know, Kin is horrified at it and then kind of does it herself later.
Yeah.
And it sort of comes to a head not far past that. When they're deciding whether or not to let Svandor go or kill him.
Mm.
And Kin makes the argument, I'm pretty sure the Disbuilders are human and are therefore going to respect the human attributes of mercy and fair play, and that means we should let Svandor go, because it's what the Builders, and at this point obviously she doesn't know who the Builders are, would want.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, yeah. So willing, almost.
Yeah.
Humanise oneself to them.
Exactly. And this book goes into quite an interesting interrogation. I mean, it talks a lot about the fact that Kin feels like she's got a lot more kinship with Marco and Silver than she does with the actual human beings on the disc, because they have the shared experiences that the humans on the disc wouldn't.
That's very quick trauma bonding, I must say, with the whole, not even eating in solidarity with Silver. And
yeah.
Of course, we'll land with her. And
yeah, I like the bonds between the characters.
I do, yeah.
Even if a lot of the time where Kin does things, it's almost like a, look at how good she is.
Yes, yeah, definitely. It's a little bit of a... Well, it's practically very much like having decent protagonists, doesn't he? It's just, I think usually he has a bit more time to set up the protagonist as such. He's got like this strong morality that he tries to instill in.
And a lot of the times it is also her trying to bring out the human side of Marco. She has the idea first because she is the more human one. And it goes into how Marco and Silver relate to her when they are both technically not human. Obviously, with Marco, it's dubious, but it's sort of established by the end, like, no, okay, so he really is a Kung.
Yeah.
And this goes back to my quote early on. This idea of being cosmopolitan is relating to humans.
Yes.
I can't quite remember. I've noted like 20,000 fucking quotes.
Excellent.
Look, I wanted supporting evidence for my dissertation on the fact that I don't know what humanity is. Silver and Marco are discussing this idea of being cosmopolitan. In fact, Marco says, we've been around humans too long and we're tainted by their madness. And this is, there's another sort of thing about humans being the essential lunatic element.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why, Silver puts it, she describes being cosmopolitan as the voluntary subjugation of one's racial awareness in the light of the basic unity of sapient kind.
Ooh, a little bit of Earth parallel.
Exactly. It means we learn to speak languages that their tongues can handle. We get along in their world. You don't see a human act like a Shand or a Kung.
No.
And Silver
sort of... Kin tried to speak Shandy at the beginning, did she not?
She did.
Yeah.
And again, this is what I mean about Kin being this sort of fundamentally decent and cool. And I don't mean cool as in she's a cool girl. I mean cool as in she gets on with everyone
chill.
Very well.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Silver has this whole thing of, you know, we like humans. They take the lead and they tend to get what they want. They're this essential lunatic element. And then Silver says, maybe if we didn't like humans, we'd be dead.
Yes, that's it, isn't it? It rather suggests there's perhaps some species that didn't like humans, but did not survive the expansion.
Yeah, so it's this weird thing of as the book interrogates humanity, it doesn't delve into the theme as much as I'd like. It's sort of these conversations that happen and we never really get these conversations affecting the plot. But it is sort of this colonialism thing. It's not that everyone becomes like everyone else. It's that everyone conforms to this central ideal, which in the book is humanity. But if you look at what our actual world is, it's trying to make everyone a bit more Western.
Yes. Yeah.
And I feel like just on the podcast list, colonialism, bad.
I think we did that, but yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Checking. Thumbs down. Still Kate good.
Yeah. Do you take that to an interstellar level? How woke are you? Answer one of the massive questions of humanity's future for me at a moment's notice on the podcast. Go on.
Yeah, sure.
Make it woke. Nobody will disagree and cancel us.
let's try not to be dicks.
Okay, that sounds good.
Yeah. This is the main tenet I mostly live my life, but that's not true. I'm a dick.
I mean, we try, I feel.
I attempt it.
We call ourselves out.
All of my dickheadishness is very lighthearted and well-intended.
Sure.
Anyway, so yeah, back to the big philosophical questions. When it finally comes down to what the disc needs, other than, you know, a better planet being built near it and everyone being ferried over.
Yeah.
It's not described as needing humanity, it's described as needing sapience. As in the person to take the chair, the person to run the disc for the committee, they want something sapient. You know, it can't be run by a rock or a vegetable.
Yeah.
But they don't specify human.
No. Although, probably they had human in mind just by going what they seeded the planet with. But
well, yeah, I mean, they sort of had this thought of human as default. And this is the whole thing it comes back to with the builders.
Yeah, so again, it's the rug being pulled out, isn't it? It's like we're coming to this conclusion that why is human as default? And then at the end it's like, humans are default.
Humans are default because they're made in the builder's image. They build planets as the builders built universes.
If I was a wanker, I'd try and say this was some kind of subconscious admission that God must exist, but obviously not.
No, not, I don't think that's even slightly what he's going for here. Nope. It's a nice play on why things... It's a what if this is why things are the way they are?
Yes, yes, yes.
And obviously it is a big
what
if, and
that's... what if thing was why? No. I'm trying to
What happens when thing happens? Why things happen because what? Thing happened?
Yeah. Yes.
I'll do you one better. Why is Gamora... Sorry, that's only funny to like five of our listeners. I just rewatched all the MCU films.
I don't know what you're about.
Yeah, that's fine. We don't MCU? Need to. Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Oh, event. Well, I imagine more than five of our listeners then. That's not your most niche interest.
God, I'm so basic.
I assumed it was an anime.
Right? I don't watch anime.
I'm
not
a nerd
weird.
Girl. I like comic books. I'm a shit nerd girl.
I am a very tired nerd girl.
I like Discworld to make lists of interesting adjectives.
And as we pointed out in the podcast subreddit the other day, possibly the most nerdy thing we do is writing each other physical letters with wax seals set in a fictional world.
Look, look, look. The real world was shit for the last year.
No, the real world's still shit. Can we please keep doing this?
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. I haven't had time to write back yet, sorry.
Have day. Anyway,
what are we talking about? Oh yeah, humanity. Oof.
Yeah. Oof. But I think there's something as a starting thing here that becomes a big Pratchett theme. Like this whole idea of colonialism and being more human definitely comes up again with the dwarves and the trolls in the Discworld books. But I think this idea of humans meaning people.
Yeah.
Being A, basically decent, and B, fascinatingly curious, at poking things and seeing what happens, is something that comes up again and again in the Discworld. And if you take it out a layer into looking at the writer, this whole thing of what happens when thing happens and speculative fiction is what he does. He puts things into the disc and sees what works and what doesn't.
This does seem to be a nice manifestation of one of his preferred phrases of the when the falling angel meets the rising ape.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is one of my favourite quotes. And sort of following on from humanity, you wanted to ask what life was.
Yes, so life as being the within the solar systems, life directing thing, life being a lot more abstract than you'd think if you were taking a purely carbon-based view of life. And I do like that because it was going to tie in with the thing I was hoping to find and never did, which was that passage of, like, what if dark matter creatures existed? Which I do know is part of that particular Stephen Baxter series. But, the concept of life being what is it? What is it? What makes something an automated
by sapience or
because
intelligence
obviously.
Or, yeah.
Because like a sea cucumber is alive, we think. But I don't think many people would argue a sea cucumber is sapient. And
clearly you've been talking to the wrong sea cucumbers.
I'm ashamed to say I haven't talked to any sea cucumbers at all in preparation for this episode. I am speaking from a place of complete ignorance. Disclaimer. Obviously, I don't know what to say. Sorry. What sea cucumbers go through?
Check your sea cucumber.
Quite problematic, actually. Oh my gosh. Anyway, this is a very vague, rambling thing of saying, what is life, actually?
Yeah. We don't have an answer for this, but if the listeners have got one, on a postcard to the usual albatross.
Yeah, I think it's why I liked the theory in this so much, is even though it did come tumbling down, it's one of those things that kind of breaks my brain in a nice way, not like quantum, more like,
It just keeps getting bigger. It's the Russian doll of existence.
Yeah. This is like the whole tree falling in a wood thing. It gets me to the glassy-eyed stare state, which I will try not to get into during the podcast.
Yes, thank you for that. And speaking of life, let's talk about immortality.
Oh, yes, let's.
You've been looking forward to talking about immortality since you first realised it was a theme in this book, haven't you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I thought it was interesting because the distinction is here between immortality and longevity, and longevity being what each individual human is reckoning with, because he was quite careful near the beginning to say that these humans weren't expecting nor really striving for immortality themselves, because fairly early on in the grand scheme of things, at about 250, did he say? 300?
Yeah.
Basically, the increased risk-taking behaviour eventually does for you, and that doesn't seem to be seen as a tragic thing. It doesn't seem to be something they're trying to avoid.
Well, it's like with the Spindle Kings, which obviously, like I said, now we know they don't exist, but...
Yeah. Let's pretend they do. For the sake of this section, can we pretend the last 50 pages didn't happen?
But the Spindle Kings... they died out because they were psychically overwhelmed. And then it's like, that's what happens on a smaller scale to the humans that try and live for a long time.
Eventually, oh, yeah, with the mind quakes. That was interesting.
Yeah.
I want to hear more about that. What was that?
I don't know. I got a headache just reading that sentence.
Anyway, sorry. My point was that longevity kind of allows for the immortality, I think, in this, in the company's mindset here. The idea that humans need to be able to mature more than we currently can in order to reach the full potential. Mm-hmm. Have you read The Trouble with Lycan?
No, I haven't. Wyndon's? You talked to me about it.
Yeah, you would enjoy it. It explores very similar themes, obviously. And about the same age range as well, actually, that the Lycan thingy manages to get people to about 200, 300 years old, something like that. Right. And the talking points around there are how much better humans could be. Let's think about how much older and wiser we could be if we could, you know, actualize. I like that word today. I always sound a bit mad when I talk about, like, never wanting to die.
No, but I do understand it. In fact, the more we've talked about it, because this has been, like, something that keeps coming up on the podcast from when we first started recording, and you've even got me from, no, I want to die at 70 because, God, I don't want to be alive for too long, too. Actually, yeah, no, you're right. I do want to be immortal.
Yeah, the thing is, I don't want to linger on and, like,
empty black void of space.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And what I want is for aging to be stopped in some way. And again, it's not a vain thing. It's I don't want my brain to degenerate. You're not as into CDP Grey and Hello Internet and that as I am, are you?
No, I've listened to the odd episode.
Yeah. So CGP Grey, I think, is the person who managed to solidify this idea in my head the most. If anyone's interested, what you want to do is watch first CGP Grey's video, Why Die, and then listen to episode 91 of Hello Internet, Last Man to Die. But the basic idea is that, so death as a part of life, giving life meaning, is kind of the argument you get a lot against the idea of humanity wanting to live forever. It's Stockholm Syndrome. It's us convincing ourselves that what we're in the grip of is okay because we can't see any alternative. But because of that, like, anyone who really puts, like, politically, more than scientifically, anyone who put focus on that would be seen as a complete crackpot. But it's going to need to happen at some point. And as we do keep making advancements in things like gene therapy, which is kind of very hinted at here, it starts becoming more possible. And I think, you know, there is a possibility that the first nearest damn it immortal generation has already been born. God damn, you don't want to be on the wrong side of that line. No. Do you think humankind would be improved if we could double our lifespan? So I'm going to give this, like, the unrealistic universal ability to do so, because we all know if, like, we had some medicine tomorrow, it would be hoarded and fucked with under free market capitalism. But let's just say we can live to 200-ish instead of 80-ish.
I can see what the book is doing with the boredom hitting after a certain point, but I do think it would be an improvement for humanity, because there's more to learn, there's more to do.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, in a lot of senses, we are sort of tiny, terrified, panicked monkeys running around trying to put off death.
Oh, in most senses, yeah.
And if you sort of take that, if you move that cliff edge further away, you put so much more in the path of that cliff edge. And I think by putting everything in that path, you lose a lot of selfishness. And I'm speaking as an incredibly selfish person, but I think a selfishness and a certain lack of empathy is where a lot of negativity in the world comes from. I don't mean, like, negative vibes, but a lot of the things like free market capitalism and the things that we don't really like.
Yeah.
I think by allowing longevity, you take away, you add empathy, you take away the selfishness, because you simply cannot continue experiencing things with the level of cognitive ability that we've got at, say, 30, or a completely functioning person has at 30. I mean, us, maybe not so much.
All right.
No, I'm mostly
functioning
me.
Better than I ever have.
Mostly me, again. I'm very tired. I think by giving someone the opportunity to garner so much more experience, you cannot help but be more sympathetic for your fellow man and more worried about the state of the earth.
Yeah.
I think if you're thinking, well, it doesn't matter if global warming happens because it'll happen after I'm dead, that's not the same thing if you're still going to live for it.
Yeah. Yeah, the fact that so many massive decisions are made under short-term benefit analysis is obviously a huge problem for the species, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, you can, if you shrink it down, the fact that so many businesses make quarter-to-quarter decisions for shareholder reasons is to detriment of a lot of these businesses, and then scale it up on a worldwide scale. Yeah, absolutely. I don't have grandchildren to think about. And even people who do, obviously you want the best for your grandchildren or your, you know, your potential great-grandchildren, but the further you get away, the less real that seems.
It's also impossible to imagine. I can't imagine 100 years from now.
Oh, no, absolutely. Of course not. Yeah.
No.
But I want to, yeah.
But I would like to see
it. I don't like cliffhanger. It's all about this, Joanna. I've got massive FOMO. I've got eternal FOMO.
I don't want to miss out what happens. Although I've been watching Futurama because I needed a very brainless background binge.
Nice.
And
harsh.
It's actually a good show. I forgot how good and how funny it was in places.
I love Futurama.
But, you know, as I was saying, what's going to happen in the year 3000? Not much has changed, but they lived underwater. Sorry, I tried really hard not to.
I was listening to that the other day. I put my terrible pop playlist back on. What's it called? Ridiculous Pop, the one I made to move you from house to house. Yeah.
It's a very good playlist. We've tangented. Do you have a conclusion to come back to on the nature of immortality?
Oh, wait. God, now I've just got busted in my head. Shit. Basically, I think that we should absolutely be striving to live longer and fight age as a kind of degenerative disease more than an inevitability. And I think we should stop looking at people who think otherwise as crackpots just because it sounds massively super villainy. That's not where we're coming from.
This is not
ignore this long-haired white cat that I'm gently stroking. Ignore the monocle I've suddenly materialized onto my face. Not a super villain. Genuinely concerned for the future of humanity and my own fear of missing out.
I promise this is not coming from a place of super villainy. But no, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. To tie it back into the book.
Yes, please.
That we are apparently discussing. There's a sort of thought process that King goes to early on with the Bjorn Chang and the Settlers.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and she thinks
still
about
a really good band name. Yeah, I see it.
She thinks about the fact they're going to settle on this planet. They won't have gene therapy there. They will live normal human lifespans.
Mm-hmm.
And their version of longevity, the word's lost all meaning, is to have children and pass them down and build a civilization from scratch. And
legacy.
Yes, exactly. Their version of longevity is legacy.
And people do seem to have a natural inclination towards that as a comforting mechanism, and I simply do not.
Yes, I have absolutely no desire to leave a legacy on the basis of offspring.
No, or anything else, to be honest.
Well, no.
I would like, obviously, I would like to leave the world a better place than I came in. But like the kind of core concept actually that drives a lot of the progress here is something missing from me, unfortunately. Which the idea that leaving your mark on the universe is the comforting factor. Nah.
Yeah, but I'm okay without that. So that's their version of legacy. When you come out to the bigger spectrum of the builders building and then the humans building and creating the planets, the reason humans built and spread out across the entire universe building these planets was not to develop gene therapy in days and live for 300 or 400 years. It was to make humanity immortal.
Yes.
And again, it was always about legacy as longevity. It was never about living for 400 years.
Mm. Yes.
And I think that's an interesting way to look at immortality because neither of us have that driving thing of legacy and we both are driven a lot more by FOMO.
Yeah. Anyone who does like have that driving force, we would be interested to hear from, I think.
Yes, send us your thoughts on immortality and legacy.
Via rock, if you don't have any albatross available.
Yes.
Not like through the window, like the legendary bird. Yeah. God, I wish that was pronounced slightly differently.
Or just like email
he flew
us.
Like a rock. What do I mean?
Or yeah, you know, you can email us. That's an option.
Sure, why not?
Anyway, I don't have anything more to say on that, do you?
No.
Cool.
I think I've ranted enough for now.
Have you got an obscure reference, Finial, for me?
Well, yes, perhaps a little more ranting. This is only very vaguely tied to the book. Gonna be honest, probably not the best obscure reference I could have chosen. but it connects to something really cool, so I'm going to use it. So when they are talking about communicating with humans on disk or getting information out, Silver says, Marco, slugs a likely looking object, flies him over here and knocks the shit out of him until I've heard enough. That's the technique.
Oh, yeah.
And Kin says, it's not like drawing circles in the sand, is it? Mm-hmm. I go, I felt like that was a reference to a specific thing of like drawing circles in sand to communicate with each other. That sounds very familiar to me on a...
It was also mentioned earlier in the book. When they first land and meet Erickson and that lot, and Kin says if they don't have a common language, she'll have to draw circles in the sand to communicate.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
them.
Sorry, yeah, yeah, but it wasn't, like, explained as to...
Oh, no, it wasn't explained, yeah. It was just mentioned.
Yes, communicating with other cultures via circles in the sand. I was like, that phrase sounds really familiar. And, unfortunately, as always, Google is ruined by pop culture and some, 80s song called Circle in the Sand flooded it, and I didn't have time to get through that. But I did a slightly different branch of searching, and... There's something called Vanuatu sand circles, Vanuatu sand drawings. So in the, this South Pacific Vanuatu Islands
archipelago.
Archipelago, thank you.
No, I'm just pleased to see you.
There's 80 different language groups in that thing. And a way they communicate with each other is via sand drawing. So they can it's really cool. So they can communicate meaning through these complex and very beautiful, I must say, sand drawings. And so it can be ritual communications or just feelings and stuff like that. It's really very cool. But that is cool. But what's cooler is where I found out about it is this website called, it's under the UN. UNESCO, and it is called the List of Intangible Cultural Heritage. Cultural Heritage, right?
That name.
Right, anyway, there's this massive list of really cool intangible cultural heritage stuff that I found about 10 minutes before I needed to start setting up for this recording. So I haven't looked through this properly, but I'm going to link it, and I think you will as well, and this looks like a fantastic procrastination / research tool.
Excellent. I'm very excited about that.
Cultural heritage.
That sounds so cool.
Yeah, doesn't it? So yeah, that's that.
Awesome. Well, I think with that, we've said, there's a million more things I could say about this book, but we've said everything we've got time to say about Strata. Pratchett's third Discworld novel.
It's not a Discworld novel.
Pratchett's third novel, proto-Discworld novel. I'm just used to putting the word Discworld novel.
I know.
Dickens' famous Discworld novel, Great Expectations. Anyway, yeah. So we are going to come back on the 25th of May with some fun bonus content for your ears.
A little bit cash stuff.
Very cash. We might chat a bit about a couple of the essays from A Slip of the Keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
And then we will be back properly on the disc on the 7th of June with part one of our discussion of soul music, which I'm really excited about.
Ah, yeah.
A few days before my birthday, just in case my birthday's on the 10th, in case, you know.
I know.
No, it's for the listeners. For the All listeners. Right. Well, want to wish me a happy birthday. You don't have to do that. However.
Yeah, it's compulsory. By listening to the end of this podcast, you've
entered into a contract.
An implicit verbal contract. Side effects include.
Anyway, thank you for listening to the Two Shall Make You Fret. If you would like to contact us with anything, including birthday wishes for me, you can. You can follow us on Instagram at the Two Shall Make You Fret, on Twitter at Make You Fret Pod. You can join us on Facebook at the Two Shall Make You Fret. Join our subreddit community, r/TTSMYF. You can send us your thoughts, queries, castles, albatrosses, and snats, the Two Shall Make You Fret Pod @gmail.com. And if you would like to support us financially and get a little bit of bonus nonsense for your trouble, you can go to patreon.com/ the truth shall make ye fret. As always, please don't forget to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, especially Apple Podcasts, because it helps other people find us, and we like it when they do that. Thank provided you. It's to listen to the podcast.
Yeah Don't find us.
If you are an anglerfish, please don't turn up on my doorstep.
Schlop schlop. Ooh,
schlop.
Oh, that's what I call a nice circular podcast
orbit.
All right, Jo.
And in the meantime, dear listener, Kin thought about the second edition. The ship fell onwards into the scenery.
It's a bit of a fucking mess, the end of this book, to be honest.